Okay, so before we get to Shabtai Tzvi, I need to give a very brief introductory a few comments about a really arcane subject, and that is the mysticism associated with Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Ari. Now, some people would say that one is not supposed to study this without special preparation. But since I don't really understand it, I'm not going to be telling you anything that could possibly be prohibited. But I do have to say a few things so that we can understand what happened during the course of the Sabbatean movement. But what I'm saying is so oversimplified that if a Lurianic mystic, an adherent of the Kabbalat Ha'ari were to hear me say it, he would probably have me brought up on charges of blasphemy. So, the first kind of underlying issue that was addressed by Lurianic mysticism, and we're talking about a system that was constructed in the middle of the 16th century. The Sabbatean movement is in the 17th century. There is a problem of how God could have created the world since God is omnipresent, and there needed to be a space for the world. And so God contracted his essence. This is called Tzimtzum. And what was left after the contraction was a relatively empty space. But there was an impression left of what was there before. What was prepared were what the Kabbalists called kelim or vessels, even though at this early stage you really shouldn't use that term, that would accept, would hold the divine lights that were going to be emanated into this relatively empty space. However, a catastrophe took place. Why is a whole other story. And the vessels, or most of them, broke when they were hit by these divine lights. And they descended into lower worlds. And after this entire process is completed, the Tzimtzum and the Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, the husks of the broken vessels in the lower, in the lowest of the worlds, come to be seen as evil. So the term for evil in this system is klipa, husk, or klipot, husks. And the way that the world will emerge from this evil, and that means at the time of the redemption, is by extracting the sparks of holiness that are trapped in these vessels. The vessels gain their life force from these sparks of holiness, or nitzotzot kedusha, that are trapped in them. If you can get those sparks of holiness out, the klipot will die and evil will cease to exist. This process of getting out the sparks of holiness from the vessels is called tikkun, or restoration. And that works by doing mitzvot with the proper intent. And by doing so, you kind of attract out the sparks of holiness from the world of evil. End of a near blasphemous summary of the elements of Lurianic mysticism that we need to know in order to proceed with an understanding of certain elements of the Sabbatean movement. We're not going to encounter them right away, but we will by the end encounter them in very important contexts. Okay. Now I hope we're moving to something that I actually may know something about. Shabtai Tzvi was born in 1626 in the port city of Smyrna or Izmir in present-day Turkey and in the Ottoman Empire. According to the Sabbateans, he was born on Tisha B'Av, which is a good day for the Messiah to be born. Gershon Scholem, whom I'll be quoting frequently and wrote the standard, really great work about Shabtai Tzvi, thinks that this is plausible because people were sometimes named Shabtai because they were born on Shabbos. And that year, Tisha B'Av came out on Shabbos. Now, there were other Shabbosim in that year. But in any event, the Sabbateans affirmed that he was born on Tisha B'Av. He had an uneventful youth. He was well-educated. And at the age of 22, in 1648, he started to do strange things. And I'll tell you some of them, just going through them briefly. He started in Smyrna itself, but he continued on and off with such actions for the next decade plus, as he went from place to place in the Ottoman Empire, having been forced to leave Smyrna. Some examples. He pronounced the forbidden divine name. He told the sun to stop in its tracks, which of course was done by the first figure who brought the Jews into the land of Israel. He took a fish, decorated the fish, put it in a crib, and declared that this was because the redemption of Israel will come b'mazal dagim, in the constellation of Pisces. He observed all three regalim in 1 week, making a seder in a sukkah. I used to say he probably ate blintzes, but he really said tikkun le'el shavuot, which already existed by his time. Some of these things are just strange. Some of these things have a clearly messianic character. Some of them flirt with forbidden acts. He married two women consecutively and did not consummate the marriage in each case, and it ended. And later on, he performed a marriage ceremony between himself and a Sefer Torah. He made a chuppah, he invited people, and he married the Torah. Now, Scholem argued that these strange acts took place during Shabtai Tzvi's manic state, because Scholem was convinced that he suffered from manic depression. This has to do with the fact that the Sabbatean texts speak of moments of illumination, and moments in which he descends to fight the klipot. Scholem decided that this is an indication of a manic depressive illness. Not everybody agrees with him. You can't easily diagnose a person at this distance, but he does seem to have had, I think, moments of. I think there's enough evidence that he had the moments of so-called illumination and moments of what I think we would call depression. I'm going to give in to the temptation of telling you a family story. I didn't ask for permission, so I don't know for sure how the subject of the story will react, but she shouldn't be upset. My wife's little sister is known to many of you, certainly those in Teaneck. Rachel Friedman is the dean of Lamdeinu, which is an excellent institution for adult Jewish education, and she is an extraordinary Tanakh teacher. She was the batzikunim of my in-laws, of my wife's parents. We got married when she was four. While we were dating, she insisted that I tell her what she called storias, Astoria was a story about Jewish history. So one of the stories I told her was Shabtai Tzvi, about Shabtai Tzvi. I think it's a good story. 3 years later, somebody who knew that I had told her stories asked her if I had told her about Shabtai Tzvi. And the response from the seven-year-old was, "Oh, you mean the manic depressive." So this kind of settles it that Sholem was right. In any event, at the end of this period of more than a decade of wandering in the heart of the Ottoman Empire, he moved to Egypt and cultivated a rich Jew there, and then moved to Israel, where he had some followers, but although he had made messianic references to himself over the years, he had not begun anything resembling a messianic movement. He was sent back to Egypt as a shaliach to collect money for the Jerusalem community. He went, he was successful. And there he contracted a marriage that lasted, but it was not without its peculiarities. There was a Polish Jewish woman, young woman named Sarah, who had a dubious sexual history, who went around announcing that she was going to marry the Messiah. Shabtai Tzvi heard of that and sent for her, and he actually married her. And his followers said that this is connected with God's command to Hosea that he marry a prostitute, an Eshet Zinunim. And now comes the key moment for the movement itself. There was a precocious fellow in his early 20s living in Gaza named Nathan, who claimed to have a prophetic revelation. And the revelation read, if I can, I'm going to share a screen with you. It's a one sentence prophecy. It says, "Host disabled screen sharing." Could this be enabled?
Working on it.
Okay. No, it still says.
Working on it. Just hold on 1 second.
Okay.
How about now?
All right, let's try. Very good. Should work. Here we go. This is a one sentence prophecy. Ko amar Hashem, thus said the Lord, Hine Moshiachem ba, your Redeemer is coming. Shabtai Tzvi Shemo, his name is Shabtai Tzvi. And then comes a half of a real verse. Yariah af yatsriach ha'oivavit gabar. He will cry out aloud and overcome his enemies. That was the one full-fledged prophecy that Nathan claimed to have. Shabtai Tzvi went to meet him after he made this announcement, and he apparently actually had to convince him that he was the Messiah, but he succeeded in doing so. I have to say that I'm not seeing how I can eliminate the screen share. Can you do that? Can you tell me how to do that, or show me how to do it, or do it yourself? Oops, Shmuel.
Sure.
I see it. Excellent. Excellent. Okay, very good. So he spoke to Shabtai Tzvi and he met. And apparently he needed to spend some time convincing Shabtai Tzvi that he really was the Messiah. And he succeeded. And so Shabtai Tzvi then returns to Jerusalem. People said that he left as a shaliach and returned as a mashiach. Nathan's critical role in this led Shalom to, I think, is a very apt observation. He said that Nathan of Gaza was both the John the Baptist and the Paul of the Sabbatean movement. By this he meant that he announced the movement, he was the herald of the movement, just as John the Baptist was, according to the Gospels, a herald of Jesus. And then, as we shall see, after the movement hit a moment of tremendous crisis, he was the person who developed a theology that should explain why this terrible thing happened, which in a certain sense is what Paul did for Christianity. He then sent a letter to the Jewish world, as it were, and it began as follows. Achenu Beit Yisrael, brothers of the people of Israel, Yadua Lehevei Lachem, you should know, Shenolad Mashiachenu, our Messiah was born, Bekehila Kedoshah Smyrna, Nikra Bishmo Shabtai Tzvi, his name is Shabtai Tzvi, Asher B'Meherah Tigaleh Malchuso, his kingdom will be revealed soon, V'yikach Keser Malchus Merosh Melech Yishmael, he'll take the crown from the head of the king of the Muslims, V'yosim al Rosho, put it on his head, V'amelech Yilech Acharov Ke'eved Kina'ani, Kilo HaMelucha. This is the beginning of a longer letter that was circulated around the Jewish world. And Shabtai Tzvi then leaves Israel, goes back to Smyrna, and exercises genuine power. And it's quite clear that most of world Jewry was caught up in this movement. And this is completely unprecedented. There was no messianic movement in all of Jewish history that came close to the success of Sabbateanism, except, of course, the one in the first century, which was part of the title of this talk. But since Christianity, no Jewish messianic movement came anywhere near the success of Sabbateanism. And the truth is that the success of Sabbateanism, the immediate success of Sabbateanism, was much greater than the immediate success even of Christianity. And so we are faced with a historical question or a historiographical question. What explains this? I mean, this is an absolutely unprecedented phenomenon. And historians have struggled to try to explain how this took place, how this was possible, that within months, the entire Jewish world just about was taken over by this belief. A number of major suggestions have been floated over the years, have been proposed over the years by historians. The first explanation that was given in the history of the historiography of this movement was to connect it with the monumental events of 1648 in Poland. There have been a number of two chat questions. I'll just say quickly that the Bar Kokhba movement of the second century, I didn't count because it was not purely a messianic movement. It was a revolt against Rome. And the degree of success that it had did not result, I don't believe, and very few historians believe, primarily because of its messianic a character. The messianic character is there, but it's not a normal messianic movement. The other question is the motivation of Nathan of Gaza, and my answer to that question is I don't know. He's a person who had visions. Sometimes people have visions that can't easily be explained from the outside. In any event, I don't know the answer to that question. Now, the tragedy that beset the Jews of Poland in 1648 was probably the worst attack against Jews in terms of number of casualties since antiquity, since, if you wish, Bar Kokhba. There's no question that it had an impact. And it had messianic overtones also. There were people who pointed to the fact that Tafchet, which is the Hebrew 408, which is 1648, is the Hebrew year 5408, that Tach, 408, is the gematria of a standard phrase for the suffering that will precede the coming of the Messiah. Chevlei Mashiach equals exactly 408. Jews refer to this as Gezerot Tach, the persecutions of 408. Someone once asked me a question, which I got right. I was proud of myself that I got it right. You have already a tremendous hint here. He said that the Encyclopedia Judaica, in English, which is an English encyclopedia, has many articles that were written in Hebrew by Israeli scholars that were translated by people working for the editorial staff. So there was an article about a 17th century Polish rabbi, and the translator submitted a translation to the editors, which said that this 17th century Polish rabbi was killed by the decree of the scholars. 17th century rabbis were not killed by the decree of scholars. So the question was, what was the original Hebrew? Many of you, I think, can figure out, in light of what I just said, that the original Hebrew was that he was killed b'gzeirot tach, in the persecutions of the year Tafchet, but Tafchet is also a standard abbreviation for Talmidei Chachamim. So that this was the imaginary death at the hands of scholars. In any event, aside from the gematria of 408, the Zohar identifies that year as the year of the resurrection. There were two biblical verses that were cited in this connection. One is the one I'm pointing to now, Bishnat Hayovel Hazot. Zot is 408. Tashuvu Ishel Nachalato. You will return to your inheritance. That's the redemption, right? That's in the Zohar. Then in a kina written by the Shach for these tragedies, he also says that the redemption was expected that year. And he cites a different verse, Bezos Yavo Aharon El HaKodesh. In the year Zos, Aharon will return to the presumably Holy of Holies. Now, the idea that in a potentially redemptive year, Satan makes great efforts to reverse the situation and that he can succeed was developed to explain the fact that a year that was expected to be the year of the redemption, and especially one that the Zohar said would be the year of resurrection, turned out to be a terrible tragedy. Or there was simply the sense that there are years in which events of great moment can happen and they can go in either direction. They can be redemptive or they can be tragic. There is a line in one of the Crusade Chronicles that said that the Jews expected redemption in the astronomical calendrical cycle in which the year 1096, the year of the First Crusade, took place. It's the 19-year cycle. It's the 256th 19-year cycle on the Jewish calendar. 256 is renew, and they cited a verse, Renu Yaakov Simcha. Jacob should have joy in the cycle of renew. So there is such a notion, and it was applied to 1648. However, as an explanation of Sabbateanism's appeal, these persecutions are problematic. Shalom made a strong argument against them, saying that these persecutions were in Poland, and Sabbateanism begins and is strongest in the East. And so to give an explanation that is primarily out of the area where the movement began and flourished most seems implausible. And I would add that the correlation between periods of persecution and of messianic movements is not at all clear. Gerson Cohen wrote an essay in which he made this point, that when you look at the persecutions of medieval Jews, they don't really correlate with messianic movements in any particularly clear fashion. Still, I would say that since Ashkenaz has little history of active messianism, Polish Jewry may have been more receptive because of the recent disaster. And so we move to the second large explanation, which was Sholem's own explanation. He believed that Lurianic mysticism that I described to you was widely known through Musar books. You didn't have to be a Kabbalist. And it sort of produced a graphic picture of a world on the verge of redemption. The last sparks of holiness were still embedded in the world of evil, but most of them had been removed. And therefore, there was a certain urgency and expectation. There was a sense that the redemption was on the cusp of being realized. And therefore, the Jewish world was ready for this in a way that had not been true before. Now, his position has been rejected by important scholars, first by Moshe Edel, but also by others, on the grounds that Lurianic mysticism was, in fact, not that widely known. It was not that widespread. Even among Kabbalists, it wasn't that popular yet. And so to assign this kind of significance to this arcane set of beliefs seems implausible. And I think that's probably right. And so there is a third large explanation that I'm actually attracted by. And that is that there was a widespread Marano diaspora through the Jewish world in this period. People who were either former Maranos or who had Marano relatives. This is a brand new phenomenon. You don't have that in connection with earlier messianic figures. And Maranism meant living a lie about who the Messiah is. It meant that you were affirming the messiahship of a non-Messiah in an environment that makes fun of you, makes fun of Jews, for rejecting the real Messiah and waiting for one who will never come. This, I think, may really have created a level of messianic expectation that has no real precedent in Jewish history. And I'm kind of inclined to think that this might explain things, at least somewhat. I should just add as a note that I'm not persuaded that Christian or Muslim messianic expectations that some people have pointed to had a great influence on Jews. So let me turn now to other causes that can explain this riddle, that have been proposed to explain this riddle. There is another large-scale consideration but it's different from the first three because it's unrelated to messianism. Jacob Katz, the great Jewish scholar, who was not an expert in this field, made a remark in a few paragraphs, really, in one of his early books that is very important, I think. And that is that, unlike earlier messianic figures, Shabtai Tzvi shows up in a world in which international communications have been vastly improved. So that in the olden days, someone asked about the messianic movements of David Ruvaini and Shlomo Mocho. David Ruvaini wasn't really a messiah. Shlomo Mocho predicted the messianic coming, but he also wasn't a messiah himself. So these aren't really people who made messianic claims in a serious and vigorous way. In any event, in the olden days, if a messiah showed up, by the time they heard about him in another country, he would already be discredited. Here, it didn't take a long time at all for the news of this messiah to spread. Beyond that, there are more narrowly focused explanations. Unlike really any other Jewish messianic movement, this one began in Israel. And the Rambam had said in his epistle to Yemen that the messiah would appear in Israel, whatever the reason for this. It was a movement that produced a prophet, which you don't really have in earlier messianic moments or, you know, I don't want to say movements. You hardly even have real movements before. In addition, I think there's a point that I would call critical mass. Once a movement like this gets a sufficient number of followers, then it triggers all sorts of other factors that make it easier for it to spread. Opponents are intimidated because they're afraid, and for good reason. There is widespread prophecy that develops. In some of these places, there are prophets prophesying in the streets. And there is widespread repentance, which makes it very hard for rabbinic figures to oppose the movement when they see this sort of enormous value. There was one rabbi of importance named Jacob Sasportas who resisted the movement at its height. And he left us a book later in which he reproduced his letters and his efforts called Tzitzat Novel Tzvi. The question is, was there success of Sabbateanism in areas not subject to the Gzeirotach? Absolutely. The primary success was not in Poland. The primary success was in the Ottoman Empire and in the Sephardic world, although it did spread very successfully to the Ashkenazic world as well. Point connected with Sasportas that I once wrote an article about, and I discussed it once in Arena. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because I don't have time to spend. So let me just say that he appealed to Maimonides. He appealed to the Rambam because he said that Shabtai Tzvi didn't fulfill the requirements that the Rambam sets up for a messiah. He has to, certainly for what the Rambam called Mashiach Vadai, the certain messiah, he would have to build the temple in its place. He would have to bring the Jewish people back to the land of Israel. He would have to defeat all his enemies in war. And none of this happened. So these were arguments that Sasportas used, saying, he didn't know anything yet. But the yet is important. If you want to completely refute the claim of a messianic figure, you have to show either that he's an ignoramus or something like that, but otherwise you have to show that certain things that should have happened by now didn't happen. Now, how do I know what things should have happened by now? The answer is by reading certain things that you find in rabbinic sources about what will happen just at the time that the Messiah appears. There are various things like that in the Gemara. And the Rambam, the very same Rambam, because of his rationalism, wrote that we don't know exactly how the events of the Messiah's coming will unfold. And even the rabbis didn't have a reliable tradition about this. They just had to follow the verses. In other words, things you find in the Talmud about the details of this process may not be correct. And therefore, if you try to refute Sabbateanism by saying X, Y, and Z didn't happen, the Sabbatean appeals to the Rambam and shows that you can't be sure that these things need to happen. Now, then comes the next critical moment. Shabtai Tzvi goes back to Smyrna, and he has a tremendous following, as I said. But because of the fact that he was so widely successful, he came to the attention of the Muslim authorities, and he was imprisoned. He was imprisoned in a tower, but his followers gave them, gave the authorities bakshish. They paid them off, and he was treated extremely well. And his followers called this tower the Tower of Strength, Migdal Oz. And at this point, an offbeat Polish Jew named Nechemia Cohen came to see Shabtai Tzvi in that tower. And he was disturbed by the fact that certain things that the rabbi said would happen hadn't happened. For him, this was critical. And one of the things that hadn't happened was that there was no Mashiach ben Yosef. There was no pre-Messiah Messiah, which is mentioned in Talmudic sources and in Midrashic sources, who has to fight the battles of Israel. He gets killed. He's resurrected later by Mashiach ben David, but there was no Mashiach ben Yosef. And some people think that Cohen claimed himself to be Mashiach ben Yosef, even though his name was Cohen. He realized that he was in danger when he started arguing with Shabtai Tzvi, and so he told the Muslim guard that he's going to convert to Islam. And he did, and he went to the authorities, and he said, Shabtai Tzvi is dangerous. You've got to deal with him. And they listened, and Shabtai Tzvi was given the choice of conversion to Islam or death. Cohen then went back to Poland and reverted to Judaism. And at this point, Mashiach ben David became a Muslim. Now, you could argue that the Rambam said that you're allowed to convert to Islam if the alternative is death. But conversion to Islam, becoming an apostate, is still not part of the resume of the CV of Mashiach ben David. This was a monumental crisis for the believers. As Shalom says correctly, it's worse than the crucifixion. If you crucify somebody, it doesn't mean that he's an evil person. But if he converts to Islam, that's a different story. And along came Nathan of Gaza and came up with an explanation for an apostate Messiah, which is a remarkable achievement. What did he say? And it's even more brilliant than the Christian interpretation of dying to atone for the sins of humanity. What happened was, said Nathan of Gaza, is that at the very end of the process of redemption, there are just a few sparks of holiness left embedded in the world of evil. And they can't be removed from the outside. And therefore, the Messiah himself has to enter the world of the Klipot, the world of evil, and remove the sparks of holiness from the world of evil, hence bringing about the redemption. This, I think, is really brilliant. It's a transformation of Lurianic mysticism, but it uses the basic elements of it. In addition, Sabbateans pointed to biblical prototypes of people who pretended to be not Jewish or entered the non-Jewish world and for purposes of redemption. Moses was brought up in Pharaoh's palace. Esther entered the palace of Ahasuerus to redeem Israel. They looked for biblical verses the way the Christians did. And there's one that I can't resist showing you. The 53rd chapter of Isaiah is one of the most important chapters used by Christians to prove the messiahship of Jesus. And it refers to a servant of the Lord. And they took it to mean the Messiah. Most Jews in the Middle Ages took it to mean the people of Israel, but there were many Jewish sources that took it messianically also. And there's a word there that did triple duty for three different messianic movements. V'hu micholal mipesha'enu. He is micholal from or for our sins. Now, what does micholal mean? Well, Christians said it means pierced, because there's a halal cherev, someone who is killed by a sword. And so he was pierced for our sins. Sabbatian said it comes from chilul. He was profaned for our sins. And after the stroke of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Lubavitch Messianus said it was from the root for holy or machala, and it means he became stricken by illness for our sins. So you have one word that was used to perfection by three different messianic movements. After his death, after his apostasy, he died 10 years later. There were various forms of Sabbateans, some who continued to observe the Torah but believed only the Messiah has to enter the world of evil, some who started violating the Torah as a matter of principle, and some who even went so far as to attribute divinity to Shabtai Tzvi. And I'm going to read you an extremist messianic prayer. An extremist Sabbatean messianic prayer. I probably have to hesitate to read it because it's Avodah Zorah. I actually once already prayed to an idol in my life. When I was 14 years old, I was in the big play in Camp Masad, and I played a priest of Baal. And the head of stage performances was not religious. Told us that as the curtain opens for the second act, the audience will see an enormous statue of Baal, and they'll be so impressed by it that they're going to clap. So we shouldn't start right away. And they did applaud, but my job was to bow down to the Baal and pray that he kill Yeshayahu and Chizkiyahu. So at the age of 14, I had enough guts to say, I will not bow down to this statue. But I didn't have enough guts to say that I won't pray to it. So I have actually said a prayer, an idolatrous prayer in my life. I hope that the fact that nobody worships Baal anymore makes that a little bit better. So I'm going to now read another idolatrous prayer to you. I'll stop in the middle, I'll say some English words so it doesn't come out to be a full-fledged prayer. Yehi ratzon milefanecha, shetatzlichenu b'sarascha, May it be your will that you will make us succeed in your Torah, v'davikenu b'mitzvosecha, and we will and cleave to your mitzvos, v'tahera yonayla of the chabemes, and purify my thoughts to observe, to worship you in truth. Now we think up to now that we're talking about persons talking to God, right? V'sheyu kol ma'aseinu, and all our deeds should be v'torah da'atzilus. That's the highest world, which is not really the regular Torah that we have. In other words, we don't observe the regular Torah. Rak l'shimcha gadol, we should do this only for the sake of your great name. And then come two Spanish words, Señor Santo, Holy Master. L'hakir gedulascha, to know your greatness. Sha'atohu Elohim, I'm going to say Elohim MS. You are the true God, Umelech Olam, an eternal King. Meshichenu hachay, our living Messiah. Shayisa Batevel Hagashmi, who was in the physical world, Uvitalta Torah Divriya, and you got rid of the Torah of the world of Bria, which is our Torah. The Olisolim Komcha, and you went back up to your place, Lahasia Lechol Olamos, to govern all the worlds. That is how far some Sabbateans went. Now, the movement obviously was no longer mainstream, but it persisted for a remarkably long time, you know, well over a century. One of the greatest controversies between two great rabbis in Jewish history was the controversy between Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonos and Eibeshitz in the 18th century, where Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonos and Eibeshitz of being a Sabbatian. I once ran an event when I was at the City University of New York on this controversy, involving the two greatest, the greatest expert in Rabbi Yaakov Emden, namely Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, and the greatest expert on the controversy, namely Schneur Lyman. And I reserved a room that would hold about 65 people. And a person in the Center for Jewish Studies that was running this at the Graduate Center of CUNY asked me why you need such a big room for such an obscure topic that nobody is going to be interested in. And I said, you never know, you'll see. It turned out that the room was taken by another class because the person who reserves rooms made a mistake. And we had to scramble for another room. And we had to go to an auditorium that held 115 people, and it was full. And the person who was shocked by that, but she said in retrospect, she shouldn't have been so shocked because she got a letter from a person on our mailing list who said he would love to come. He's going to be out of town, but he would love to come because he had a tradition in his family that back in the middle of the 19th century, his great-grandparents did not talk to another family because they had been on opposite sides of this controversy a century earlier. Now, what was the impact of Sabbateanism? I'm just going to do this rat-tat-tat without any discussion. People have listed the following consequences. It led to communal weakness. It led to a diminution of respect for the rabbis who hadn't protected people against this false belief. It may have led to a small but significant degree of conversion to Christianity by Jews who figured, you know, the Messiah we think is coming is not coming. There are people who've connected it to the rise of Hasidism, a rebellion against the existing leadership, and elements also of, problematic halachic behavior. Arguably led to some of the opposition to Hasidism because Hasidism was seen as a neo-Sabbateanism. It led, so people have said, to the decline and transformation of traditional Jewish messianism. Sholem himself had this enormously aggressive set of consequences. He thinks, he thought that the failure of Sabbateanism led to the struggle for emancipation, because that's a different way of redemption, to the rise of the Jewish Enlightenment movement, because people were becoming alienated from traditional Judaism, that ultimately it led to Reform Judaism, maybe even to Zionism, which is another kind of redemptive movement. Now, these last four are monumental developments, monumental historical developments that would certainly have taken place without Sabbateanism. But Shalom has probably succeeded in showing that Sabbatean families were prominent in the first three of those, in emancipation, Haskalah, and maybe reform. And now, as a final word, let me leave you with a positive comment about Shabtai Tzvi. Anti-Zionists compared Herzl to Shabtai Tzvi. Right? Zionists, of course, rejected the comparison. My father, who died in 1973, so this is a long, long time ago, read me the sentence that I'm going to tell you now. My father had a stunning range of knowledge. And he showed me a book by a Zionist, a cultural Zionist named Shai Ish Horvitz. He was an author and editor of a journal. Horvitz was not only an unusual cultural Zionist, he was also a fervent Hebraist. And he also rejected the analogy between Herzl and Shabtai Tzvi, but for, shall I say, an idiosyncratic reason. Some people, he said, compare Shabtai Tzvi to Herzl, but this is inappropriate. After all, Shabtai Tzvi knew Hebrew. And with that, I leave you. So.
Thank you, Dr. Berger. Thank you very much. I think Dean Reinhold is on and will be taking over question answer responsibilities. Hello, Dean Reinhold. I leave it to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Berger.
Thank you very much. Some of you have seen me already this evening on the other Zoom link. Before you got to this one. I apologize, I can't be on screen, but I am happy to take questions if you want to put them in the chat, and then I can put them to Dr. Berger, who I'm sure will be happy to answer them. So please do type any questions into the chat, and
I'll be happy to answer them if I know the answer.
So our first question is where the prayer to Shabtai Tzvi, where that's from, the origins of that prayer that you
that is a Podolian prayer by extremist Sabbateans, which you will find, if I'm not mistaken, in Gershom Sholem's article, a famous classic article called Mitzvah Haba'ah Ba'aveira.
Okay,
I'm going to double check by sharing the screen. I think I may have written it there. So let's double check to see if I'm right. Yes, Mitzvah Haba'ah Ba'aveira, page 380.
Excellent. Okay, and we have another question here. This is from Ezra Blumenthal, asking if you can elaborate on those families you mentioned were present in subsequent Jewish movements, the families that were connected to Sabbateanism.
Yeah, so what Sholem did was demonstrate to take one example that has to do with Haskalah and to some degree with emancipation, the subscribers to an early Haskalah journal, one of the earliest Haskalah or the earliest Haskalah journal, included, we have lists of subscribers, and they included some families that we know were Sabbatean families. That's the sort of thing that he tried to demonstrate. And same was true with the people who were involved in the struggle for political emancipation.
Okay, we also have a question here. What documentation is there to suggest that so many Jews were involved with the movement?
Okay, now the evidence is roughly as follows. First of all, First of all, one example is that in Sasportas's Tzitzat Novel Tzvi, he says that he was virtually all alone in his efforts, that some of the rabbis who agreed with him were afraid to express their views. And we do know that there were serious bodily threats to some of them. And on the other side of this, there is the editor of Tzitzat Novel Tzvi of Sasportas' work, whose name was Yeshayahu Tishbi, showed that Sasportas himself was, edited his letter somewhat because during the height of the movement, he actually had to be very careful not to be too blatantly opposed because of fear. In addition to that, we know, for example, that the Taz sent two of his children to that tower where Shabtai Tzvi was, with something like regards or whatever it was. So we know that they were prophesying, the Jews were prophesying in the streets. We know that the Muslim authorities became fearful. We know that Glickel of Hameln wrote a passage in her memoir speaking about the enormous impact that this movement had, about how people moved out of their homes with the expectation of moving to Israel. Presently, as there is from all over the Jewish diaspora, there is evidence that this movement caught on. Now, I can't tell you, I can't give a number of the percentage of people who were believers or who were vigorous believers, but it seems very clear that at the very least, what I said about this being an unprecedented success is the case.
Okay, we've got questions that could keep us here all night, I imagine, but the hour's getting late, so I'll just do one or two quick questions more. Hannah here has asked that she's heard some people think there's a connection between Anun Smirot and Shabtai Tzvi, and is there anything to that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I've come across it. I've never made any real efforts to look into it, so I'm afraid to give what will look like an informed answer, which will be an uninformed answer. There's a book about Anun Smirot, by the way, that was just written, but not written from this kind of angle. By a Rebbe in NYU, a Rosh Yeshiva in NYU, Elchanan Adler, wrote a Hebrew book on Anun Smirot and with an English translation. So, I could, at least I can mention something recent, but it doesn't deal with this kind of question. And I really don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so finally, I'll just combine two. The question of how prevalent was crypto-Sabbatianism after the death of Shabtai Tzvi and how long it persisted, though also kind of related to that, somebody's asked how people maintained it after Shabtai Tzvi's death. Did they expect Tchiyas HaMetim? Did they think that he would be resurrected and hence they maintained their belief? So a two-parter there, I suppose.
So the first part was how long it lasted, right?
Yeah, how prevalent it was, afterwards.
So, it was a minority, but it was prevalent to a disturbing degree. The fact that you had that the kind of dispute that you did with Yaakov Engel and Jonathan Eberschitz in the third quarter of the 18th century, in other words, basically almost 100 years, just about 100 years after Shabtai Tzvi died, and that this could rip apart the Jewish communities, tells you something quite remarkable about the persistence of this movement in certain circles. There's much more about this. There were various other Sabbateans. They were fought against by Moshe Chagiz. There's a book by Elishava Kalibach's first book. It's called Pursuit of Heresy, which deals with the efforts to, by some people, to uproot Sabbateanism, and the fact that this was not so easy. So this was, I'm not going to give a percentage of the community that believe in him, that continue to believe in him, but it's not a trivial number. It's a small number, percentage-wise, I think, but it was not a trivial number. The next question was?
Just whether they expected he was going to be resurrected. Why they maintained their belief.
He would return.
Right. It's an interesting question here asking about the Ashkenazic Sephardic kind of percentages in terms of Sabbateans.
The Ashkenazic Sephardic?
Yeah.
Okay, so there was a book written by Bernard Weinrib, who was a good scholar, called The Jews of Poland, in which he has a full chapter polemicizing against Sholem, and arguing that the Ashkenazic Jews, the Polish Jews, were not as caught up in this movement as Sholem claimed. Now this was a book that was carefully evaluated by people in the field, who for the most part think that the arguments are unpersuasive. I'll sort of give you an example. There are different levels of belief. There are different levels of intensity of belief. In the communities where you had people prophesying in the streets, you have an enormous intensity of belief. But we have places where people said a mishaberach for the Messiah Shabtai Tzvi, but the same community, there was a communal mishaberach in the davening for the Messiah Shabtai Tzvi, and the same community would renew a lease for the next 8 years. So you ask yourself, is this a contradiction? Did they really not believe? I don't think this means they didn't believe. It's the kind of thing that Weinrib pointed to. I don't think it means that they rejected the belief that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah, but it means that the certainty was relatively diminished compared with other communities, and that throw all caution to the winds.
Okay. We have so many questions still, but I feel probably at this point we should let Dr. Berger go after a wonderful lecture for the last hour and more. And thank everybody here for joining us tonight. If you still have more questions, of course, what you can do is come join us at Revel. And either come and audit a course or get in touch via the website, email. I'm sure in his spare time, Dr. Berger would like nothing more than to answer all the other questions that were left over this evening. But thank you very much for coming. Hope to see you at Revel events in the future. We have quite an array of events and a calendar for you to go to from the website, where you'll find future events. Thank you all very much for coming tonight.